If I bleed tonight, if I am sad tonight, I don't have a job to find. And if I work tonight, if I'm so tired tonight, I'll fall asleep when I'm home, when I'm home. Hey everybody, and welcome to a brand new episode of the Power Slam podcast here on Inside the Ropes. My name is Kenny McIntosh, and I'm joined, as always, by my close friend, my mentor, the man who made me go from thinking, you know, Austin got fired at Judgment Day, maybe he'll turn up in WCW to, no he won't, you stupid idiot, he's in a multi-year deal in WWF. It's Finn Martin. Hi Finn, how are you?
I'm very well, Kenny. I'm here to impart wisdom to all. As always. No, I'm doing very well, thanks. Yeah, doing really good. I'm looking forward. Seems like, you know, things are moving forward. You know, things are unlocking and feels like, you know, we're edging slowly towards normality again, which is, you know, in terms of the lockdown, that is. So, you know, I think that's all good news.
Yeah, it's all good news. And it's funny, I was talking to my friend Jamie yesterday, and that's where the Judgment Day thing came in, because we were talking about, you know, we're 35, and we'd, you know, when we, in 1998, 1999, we were reading Power Slam when we were 13, 14 or whatever. And, you know, even though we read Power Slam, we knew kind of some of the inner workings of wrestling. You know, we still thought when Steve Austin got fired at Judgment Day in 1998, we were like, Jenky will end up in WCW? Because you're a kid and that's what you think. And we were saying, like, today's 14, 15-year-old, there's so much information out there and podcasts and all this kind of stuff that I don't know if you could still have a little bit of that naivety that you were able to have in 1998 that I would not trade. Like, I really... And it's annoying because I can't remember, obviously, my exact mindset, but I obviously was able to read some inner workings from Power Slam, but I wasn't completely devoid of letting my fantasy mind run away with me, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. And the thing was, there was a magic to it back then, which I just don't think can be underestimated. You know, and that was a big part of the charm of it. What's really going on here? And I remember that angle, and I received quite a few letters, because a lot of people had the internet by then, not that many people, but quite a few. And I remember receiving quite a lot of correspondence regarding that angle on the Monday morning, and lots of people genuinely believed that Austin had fired and that he was going to WCW. Wasn't just you and Jamie Miller.
There you go. I mean, there was more than just us.
Yeah. And obviously, he turned up on Raw the next night, and, you know, with a very famous angle, which, you know, let's not get into that angle. We'll be here for a while discussing that one. But before Raw aired the following evening, lots of people were convinced that Austin was WCW bound. And that just, I think, really illustrates, you know, Austin really sold that firing well. And for a guy who really didn't like selling anything, I thought he did a good job that night conveying with his emotions that, and his expressions that, oh my God, what am I going to do? Have I lost my job? Is it all over? And I think Austin deserves a lot of credit for the way that he communicated that message to the public, you know, with his reaction to the news that he'd been fired. So, you know, and I think it's nice to be fooled by pro wrestling. And even today in 2020, it doesn't happen that often, but when it does happen, I think it's great. I think it's tremendous when if pro wrestling still has the power to do now, I'm all for it. I would like to see that happen more often.
I think the last time that I was properly fooled and just did was the CM Punk Cena Money in the Bank build, because I just didn't know what the, you know, I didn't know the because you didn't know the specifics and you didn't know if Punk was going to stay and you didn't know what was going to happen, even though in your mind you could kind of, as an adult, go, well, you know, obviously they're not going to have him win the title unless he's signed. But in the lead-up, you kind of were able to run away with your imagination. And I remember watching that pay-per-view and just being so into that match because it felt like there was some realism. It felt like there was some shoot stuff in there. It felt like there was a crowd who just would riot if their hometown guy didn't win. So yeah, it can still do it. It's less often than it used to be, but it definitely can still happen.
Yeah, there was, you know, definite real emotion there, and that was all powered by the knowledge that earlier that year, Punk really did want to leave. He'd had enough, and that story was known to many people. And it did seem like there was a chance that at least part of this was real, and that he actually was leaving with the title. Yeah, I mean, that was huge. That was a huge angle. Well, I mean, what we're talking now, 9 years ago now, isn't it?
Summer
2011. So still talked about with great fondness to this day.
A couple other things before we get into talking about all the wrestling with SmackDown, with new champions crowned, and TakeOver with a retro feel, and Raw with the build to Backlash. I did want to ask you a couple of things. Jim Cornette had been asked a question in his podcast, and I thought it was just worth asking you the same question. And somebody had, he'd had quite a few questions recently about around the Montreal period, and, you know, if Brett had stayed, and if all these different things. And one of the things that someone had asked Cornette was, what do you think would have happened if Shawn Michaels had went to WCW? So that same question to you. What do you think if in 97, I mean, say, for example, we were to say summer of 97 when he got his hair pulled out and he said, I'm done or whatever. If he was able to go to WCW, how do you think Shawn Michaels would have fared?
I think he would have done Blair, because he would have gone in there, and Hall and Nash obviously had a lot of power then. Waltman was still there as well, wasn't he, at that point, I think? Yeah, he was.
He didn't leave till he turned up in WWF night after WrestleMania in 98.
That's right. So Waltman was there as well. I think he would have come in with a lot of support. He would have obviously joined the NWO. There may have been problems with him and Hogan, but I think they probably would have worked that out, because there would have been reasons for them to work it out, and for those two to coexist fairly peacefully, because I think there was, obviously, Michaels would have had a lot of support from Nash and Hall, who had a lot of power. So I think there would have been, you know, a collective sort of effort to get along, and to make this business relationship work. So I think Michaels would have done well in WCW. It's hard to imagine him going there, because obviously it never did happen, but he was keen to go there. He wanted to leave. Obviously, they would let him out of his contract, so it was never going to happen. And as we discovered at Survivor Series 1997, and all the information that has come out since then, and actually a lot of the information that was known prior to Survivor Series 1997, you know, Vince valued Shawn more than Brett, so there's absolutely no way that he was going to grant him a contract release to go and work for WCW, you know, because he saw him as the future of his career at that point in time. But yeah, I think he would have done well there. I think he would have made it work, and I don't know how it all would have worked out in terms of him, his life, and the WCW-WWF War of 1998. It's really hard to know how all that would have played out. It's obviously Vince's heel turn stemmed from the double cross. So if the double cross had never happened, would Vince have ever turned heel and become an on-screen character? Possibly, but we cannot know that for sure. So it's a very interesting question. And had that happened, wrestling history would have changed in ways that are almost beyond our comprehension, Kenny. What do you think? Anyway, what did Jim Cornette say?
I think he thought as well that Shawn would do well, but his point was that, you know, WCW kind of fucked up Bret Hart, so they weren't, you know, would they have just done a similar thing eventually with Shawn? But then Shawn had the political leanings, I guess,
yes,
with Nash and Hall, which you can't really underplay them. But then, in some ways, I feel like initially he would do really well, but eventually I think him and Hogan would have butted heads. Because I think Shawn would have saw himself as top dog, and when Hogan would, you know, show his clout, I don't think Shawn would have dealt with that very well, especially the Shawn Michaels of 97 or 98. What would he have called himself? That's another question, because he couldn't have been Shawn Michaels. I guess that was trademarked. So would he have been Michael Hickenbottom? I mean, you'd surely have to come up with something more
Well, it was Shawn Michaels before he joined WWF.
Oh, so he could have taken Shawn Michaels.
Yeah, it was Shawn Michaels in AWA and other companies that he worked. So there's no reason why he couldn't have used that name.
So he could have took Shawn Michaels. But there you go. Yeah, I think it's an interesting thing to think about because I think he could have done fairly well, but we'll never know.
Yeah.
And something else I wanted to ask you about, since it is the 10-year anniversary this week, Finn, yes. Stu Bennett had posted, I'm sure you're aware of where I'm going with this, Stu Bennett had posted something on his Twitter account earlier on this week, and you can also go to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/InsideTheRopes, and I think, I'm just checking as we're on here, I think it's actually our top-rated video we've ever had on our YouTube channel.
It's you talking about the SummerSlam incident.
It is. It is. Wade Barrett opening up and what really happened at SummerSlam. And as of right now, 1,414,884 people have watched that video to listen to what he had to say about what happened. But we're 10 years past the Nexus. They're very fondly remembered. The Nexus are very fondly remembered. You know, that logo, the T-shirt, the theme song, people have very fond memories of the Nexus. What are your memories of the Nexus? And, you know, as we sit here 10 years later, what is the legacy of the Nexus?
I mean, there was great hope at the beginning, I think. And, I mean, the angle when they formed and came in and trashed the ring, I mean, it was spectacular. I mean, it was 2010's version of the, you know, the CM Punk pipe bomb promo at the end of Raw. So it was like the equivalent of that. I think once the initial shock wore off the reality and, you know, looking at it pragmatically, I did wonder what it was that they could do in the company. And certainly after the dismissal of Daniel Bryan, who was, you know, clearly the best in-ring performer of the Nexus, and so crucial, I think, to the success of that faction. When he was fired, that immediately made me more concerned about the future of the act and how far they could go. And, you know, the talent that they actually had, the ability they had to get over and to be top guys in that company. I mean, it's all right coming up with an angle like that, but if the components of that faction or the members of that faction don't have the talent to pull it off, then it very quickly falls apart. And there's only so much a promotion can do. There's only so many ways to conceal their weaknesses from wrestling fans, especially by 2010 when people, you know, could see through the subterfuge. People knew what was going on. And obviously then there was the Cena factor. You know, you introduce him to any type of situation during that era, and it was basically curtains for the villains. So I was excited at the beginning because it did seem like a very bold, ambitious move by WWE, giving these young guys this huge opportunity. But I mean, when the reality of the circumstances they found themselves in and the actual talent that these guys really had and what they could bring to big matches, once all that sort of dawned on you, then I think I really, you know, it tempered my expectations. Still, you know, what happened at SummerSlam, I mean, it was pretty much over. I think it's pretty much over. Well, it was over that night and then on Raw the following night when they kind of half-heartedly tried to rebuild the Nexus the following night, if you remember. And it just felt like it was over by then. So, you know, it was, yeah, there was hopes and there was an expectation that maybe it could be something. But when you really analysed it and, you know, pulled it apart, you thought, well, how far are these guys going to go really up against, you know, these veterans and these established performers? You know, are they really going to get over and become main eventers? And of course, it's almost like the Shawn Michaels in WCW thing. You know, what would have happened to the Nexus had they triumphed at SummerSlam? How much more mileage would there have been in them had they scored a big win on that night? Would the public have viewed them differently as genuine main eventers? Or would the people have thought, well, these guys are like Vladimir Kozlovs, you know, who've received this big push, but, you know, really don't deserve it. So, you know, again, it's interesting, but...
Were they in some ways kind of set up to fail in the sense of, like, they were all kind of newer guys? And, I mean, really, if you look at the roster of Nexus, the originals, the only two that felt that they were really ready to do anything serious were Barrett and Brian.
Yes.
And everybody else kind of felt that they were just kind of side characters. And
yeah. I mean, Skip Sheffield, he suffered the pretty horrific leg injury, I think it was before SummerSlam, I believe.
Yeah, I think he did. I think it was right around that time. But yeah, I think if they had won at SummerSlam, I think Barrett would have been okay. I think that was really what did it in for Barrett. I mean, I was trying to think about this when I was talking to Sondra about it on Patreon a little bit. Was the Nexus thing the first time that Cena had worked with a sort of younger, newer guy where there was like a very obvious cutting of the legs? You know, because we would see it later with Wyatt and Rusev, but was this the first time at SummerSlam 2010? Because I was trying to rack my brain. For the most part, he'd worked with established people before that, right? This was kind of one of the first times where it was like, you know, here's a new guy. I mean, you could say Umaga, but he'd wrestled for years. But
yeah,
felt like the Nexus was the first time when it was like, here are these young guys who are kind of new. We're giving them to you to get them over.
Yes. I mean, Cena had certainly worked with younger talent prior to that, not in a storyline or feud of that magnitude, I don't think. I mean, if you think about it, it was often with, I mean, wrestling with Orton and Triple H and people like that. But I mean, the Nexus, I think, was given to him. And you think to yourself, well, why the hell would they give the Nexus to, I mean, with his track record? I mean, that there was, yeah, were they set up to fail? Well, absolutely they were, as we saw at SummerSlam, and we saw in matches between Wade Barrett and Cena in their interminable program that ran until, I think it ran until TLC, didn't it, at the end of the year?
Yep.
It did, yeah, the chairs match, that was their final match, wasn't it? So I think it was, I think that was Cena's first feud with younger guys that took place over a period of months rather than, you know, just one match or a two or three match series. I mean, I remember him having matches with younger talent on TV, and he generally wouldn't give those guys anything either. And they would usually come out of it in worse shape than when they went into it, which was, you know, typical of having a program with Cena. Obviously, you know, wrestlers like wrestling him because if they were in a higher spot, they had more money. So, you know, there was an advantage to working with Cena. But I think in terms of credibility, you know, and future prospects and, you know, career enhancement, maybe bank balance enhancement, Cena certainly achieved that, but in terms of enhancing your career and preparing you for bigger and better things, he very rarely did that with anyone throughout his entire career. Obviously, we saw him do that spectacularly Bray Wyatt at WrestleMania this year. I think he was helpful to Daniel Bryan at SummerSlam 2013, but of course then that was immediately undone by the Randy Orton run-in, so you know, that was wiped from our memory straight away, that victory Bryan scored over Cena. But if you look down the history of how many people that Cena really made, how many stars he really enhanced in his career, I mean, put people over. But that was generally then so that he could then defeat them in the next match and the match after that. So, but yeah, to answer your question, I think the Nexus was the first sort of young talent project he was given. And he lived down to, well, not lived down to expectations, because I guess expectations at that point weren't established. But in hindsight, he lived down to expectations.
And do you think that had, I guess, last question on the Nexus, do you think if they had won at SummerSlam, Would it have changed Barrett's trajectory in any way in WWE? Do you think it would have given him a better shot to kind of make it? Or do you think that kind of, because of based on kind of what point he was in his career, that it, you know, it was kind of doomed to fail, given putting him in such a high spot so young?
I mean, I think if he was going to make it there, he would have done. I mean, he obviously had a lot of injuries and he had a lot of knockbacks. I think he had a lot of misfortune, did Wade Barrett, career in WWE. But I think had they scored a big win at SummerSlam, he would have been heartened by that. And I think you can't underestimate with pro wrestling, so much of it is confidence, isn't it? Because obviously this industry is all predetermined. So it's all, everything is all based upon your internal self-belief system. If you believe you're a star and you believe you're good and you believe that the company is behind you, then I think that really results in, you know, exponential growth of you as a character and as a performer. So if you know the company is behind you, I think that can, you know, the rewards can be enormous. And if you know or believe the reverse, the opposite, that the company doesn't believe in you, then that's, you know, that festers and that just basically erodes everything that makes you a star. So it's really hard to say. Could he have become a bigger star if he'd scored that, you know, milestone win there? I mean, quite possibly. It's really hard to know. I mean, it's a shame that Brian wasn't on the Nexus team as well. Obviously, he was brought back for SummerSlam and he was on the babyface team that night. So, I mean, I think Brian was integral to the success of Nexus. He needed to be on that team. And in the end, he was on the opposing team and he ended up obviously doing really well for himself because he was incredibly talented. But I mean, the Nexus that remained, the guys that were still there, I mean, I think Wade Barrett probably did the best out of all of them. I mean, you could say Ryback had a good run there as a main eventer, but in the final analysis, did he really do that well? Well, he did become a bigger star. You know, he actually was a main eventer. But I mean, if you contrast that with where he is now, it's hard to really look back on Ryback as a success. I'm sure you'd agree with that, Kenny.
Yeah, he was. But I get, you know, again, there's similarities to where, you know, Barrett kind of needed to beat Cena at SummerSlam, and then Ryback kind of needed to beat Punk in the big match they put him in. So it was kind of similarities there as well. But yeah, Nexus is 10 years old this week, and you can go and check. I think WWE have done a best of the Nexus section of the network that you can go and check out. But anyway,
how long does that last?
I was trying not to. I was going to make a joke, but I was resisting it. But anyway, so let's talk about the weekend of wrestling. I mean, a lot going on. Let's kick it off with SmackDown, which took place on Friday night, as usual. And the big story coming out of SmackDown was obviously that Bayley and Sasha Banks were in fact able to defeat Nikki Cross and Alexa Bliss to become the new WWE Women's Tag Team Champions. Sorry. What did you make of the match and the decision to put the belts on Sasha and Bayley?
Well, I think we talked about this last week, and I think my prediction, or maybe our collective prediction, I can't remember which, was that it was they probably wouldn't win the title. So I'm really pleased that they did. I mean, I thought it was tremendous. It was very well put together, was the match. I really liked the part of it where Bayley almost sort of sabotaged Sasha, and then Sasha came in and ended up scoring the pin. She scored the pin with a crucifix, didn't she, on Nikki Cross?
Yes.
So, but prior to that, it seemed like Bayley like pushed Sasha Banks out of the ring, and Sasha was really upset by that. You think, are they going to split here? It's like, no, it's too soon. They cannot split. But Sasha did express some anger at her partner's actions. Not that it derailed them, because she came back, scored the pin, and they won the title. I mean, I thought it was really well done. I noticed as well afterwards that Alexa Bliss seemed like she was upset with Nikki Cross. So is that going to lead to something? I mean, I hope so. I know there's people out there that don't want Nikki Cross and Alexa Bliss to split, but I've said it before, and I'll say it until she turns. Alexa Bliss tasted as a babyface. She is nowhere near the star she was a couple of years ago. So, I mean, she needs to split from Nikki Cross, turn heel and try and, you know, rebuild herself as a star. But yeah, overall, thought really enjoyed the match. Thought it was very well put together, furthered the storyline, and has made the women's... So what did you think, Kenny?
Yeah, I was pleasantly surprised that they won. I think I said last week I thought it might be too soon to give them the belts, but once they had them, it just kind of felt like, you know, Bayley and Sasha are one of the best things on SmackDown, so them having the belts makes a lot of sense. There's a lot of cool story stuff that you can do out of it, as we saw on Raw. on Monday as well. And then Bailey had put a tweet out, and I want to read it out because I just think it's a testament to how good she, how well she's performed in this role. It was a picture of her and Sasha with the belts, and she just wrote, "Sheep, you better stop calling me Bailey Two Belts. I'm not a Becky Lynch replacement. Instead, you can refer to me as Bailey Dos Straps, your loving role model. Thank you and good day." And, you know, Bailey has just found this ability to be a smarmy prick. And it's great because when she turned heel last year, you know, she was just kind of playing the moody teenager, or Karen from accounting, as we called her. And
yes,
she's really elevated her game. And, I mean, Sasha's doing a great job as well. Sasha has, for years, people have wanted Sasha to have a bigger role and to be doing more. And, you know, everybody's behind Sasha. But I don't think that, as good as Sasha is here, I don't think this story works if Bailey's not pulling her end of the load as well. So I think they're both really nailing it. And like you mentioned, with the whole kind of Bailey almost costing them the match, but then Sasha managing to win it, that's just really good, subtle storytelling about how this is playing out and how their partnership's playing out. So I, when, you know, when SmackDown kind of finished with them with, you know, Bailey's got the two belts, Sasha's got the one, that keeps the story going, because even though Sasha's become a champion for the first time again in a while, Bailey's got two titles, so yeah. Bailey's still better. So there's all these little parts of the story that I really like, and I think that it's just proven as the weeks go on that the Bailey and Sasha story is doing so well because it's being given so much time to breathe. And we're just along for the ride and enjoying it.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It just feels to me like Bailey, when she did the heel turn, it was like as if they said to her, right, we want to be this character. And as time has passed, I think she's taken control of the character and has made it her own. And I think she's more comfortable now, because it's almost like people say, well, she's flopped as a heel. Well, that didn't work. So, like, she doesn't really, I think, feel the pressure anymore to perform. And it seems to me like, you know, there's a great comfort level now there with Bailey. It seems very natural. And you don't see that with many wrestlers, but I think you absolutely do see it with her. And it feels like she's in control of all of it. At times, to me, it doesn't even feel like, you know, she's following a script. It's like as if everything that she's doing is all spontaneous. Because we know where, all of us know where this is going. You know, I mean, let's face it, when we watch most action movies, we kind of know how they're going to end. But it's not really about how they end. It's the journey to the conclusion and the climax of the movie. So we know what's going to happen with Bailey and Sasha Banks. But it's like we're enjoying watching it. And it seems to me like Bailey's really enjoying the ride here. And it feels, yeah, just so smooth and so much. So a lot of pro wrestling feels forced to me, but this feels so, there's a real comfort level there between them. It's like they're not really trying. And I think, you know, that's the real sign of a pro's pro, when they can go out there and make you believe that it's, that they're not really followed and that it's not a work and that this is all, they're doing what they want to do. They're doing what their character would naturally do in those circumstances or that situation, that match or whatever. And I think you know, I'm amazed to be saying this, but I think Bailey and Sasha Banks could be the best act in WWE right now. I mean, and the other thing, just going back to what I was saying before about the company believing in you, and when the company believes in you, you believe in yourself. Bailey's got two titles right now, so you know Bailey's going to be absolutely infused with confidence, Kenny. So, I mean, you know, what must she be feeling right now? They give me two championships. You know, they are absolutely on board with me, Sasha, and this storyline. And that's a big part, I think, as well, of the success story that we are currently witnessing.
Yeah, no, I like being proved wrong with people. You know, it's, you want to be proved wrong. When you're not enjoying something, you actively want to be proved wrong, and I think we are being. I also thought, I thought the AJ Styles Daniel Bryan segment where they were talking about the IC title was really good. You know, even the kind of little nod to their different political leanings and world views kind of worked in a weird way, which was strange. But I think what worked.
It was just hilarious. Sorry, AJ, this is what Bryan said, and he almost cracked up when he said it. AJ has his way of thinking, and I have mine. And this is in reference to. So, you know, the journeys to the, you know, IC title tournament final, but it actually is about other things, and everybody watching knew that, and that was really funny.
And the big thing about it is that this whole segment was designed to make you care about the Intercontinental title, and I think that now, you know, with AJ Styles and Daniel Bryan being the two guys who are, you know, in the finals to become the Intercontinental title holder, I think it feels big, and I think that it's the first time the IC title has felt big in a long time for me, anyway. So I'm into it, and you know, then we got to see Drew Gulak and AJ Styles, and Drew Gulak got an upset win over AJ Styles, which is a good way to kind of show some doubt in AJ's mind. So, you know, the upset win was unpredictable. The promo, I thought, really built up the gravitas of the match. So I think they deserve kudos on getting to this final and having it not just feel like any other tournament they've done 100 times.
Yes, I absolutely agree. And it's a really nice setup for Sami Zayn as well when he wants to return, because they've put a spotlight on the IC title. It's risen in prominence. So when he feels ready to return, he can come back and, you know, start coming in with the outrage and, you know, how dare you do this? And the title is going to seem bigger, and that feud's going to seem much greater as well. So it's a really, you know, good insurance policy for Sami Zayn, and just really setting things up for the future. I mean, I don't know whether Bryan's going to win. I imagine we'll be in backlash predictions at some point during this podcast. But I mean, it doesn't really matter if he doesn't. I think if Bryan's champ, that obviously that benefits Sami Zayn, because Bryan versus Sami Zayn is a more natural feud. But I think Sami Zayn and AJ Styles could do something as well. I think that could work, and that would be very unexpected and different. So I think they could make a success out of that as well. So I think either way it goes. I'm looking forward to this match at Backlash, looking forward to seeing who becomes champ. Bryan was making a point of saying in this segment that he was going to defend the belt. If he were to win the title, he was going to defend it every week on SmackDown against young performers, veteran performers, and he was all about bettering himself, you know, making SmackDown, you know, superior show, and just, you know, elevating everything in his orbit. So, I mean, you know, there's a definite real focus there and a real sense of determination about winning the title, because he's got, winning it, it's not just about winning the belt. There's a purpose to this. There's a goal of winning the belt. He's got plans for it after Backlash. So in a sense, I'd like to see him win the title, because I think something like that will be good for SmackDown. But similarly, I think Styles can make a success of a title reign as well.
You know, we've praised a few things here on SmackDown, but I thought that the stuff with Braun Strowman, The Miz and Morrison was absolute garbage. I'm just flabbergasted that this is the WWE Universal Championship feud. It just feels, you know how, like, if you look at most years of WWE, you can always find like a month where there's a pay-per-view feud for a world title and like a B pay-per-view that just feels like, how is this a world title match? And that's just kind of what this feels like. And I get that we're going for comedy, and it built up to Strowman, you know, tipping the truck over, but I don't know, it didn't work for me. Did it work any better for you? Am I alone here in the woods with my ranty thoughts?
I mean, it was really infantile, wasn't it? It was just silly. It was not worthy of this title, not even worthy of this company. Certainly not worthy of pay-per-view. As you say, Miz and John Morrison were in a white surveillance van, and they set up all these cameras, and the goal was to prank Strowman, and they watched him, I think, pour water into his protein shake mixer, and it went everywhere, and Strowman had a melt. And then later, Strowman was being interviewed by Kayla Braxton, and then we went to the white surveillance van, and Miz pressed a button on a television remote control, and then a bucket of green paint landed on Kayla. It was supposed to land on Braun, and then Morrison and Miz squabble about that. I mean, Kayla was quite funny when she just said, "Those bastards." So, I mean, that was slightly news. There was some humour to be found there in the stupidity of all this. And then they went and they left the white surveillance van, Ms. Morrison, and took a golf club and a base and smashed in the windscreen of Braun's prize vehicle. Now, I thought this looked like a Volvo, you know, with a souped up. Actually, as Morrison pointed out, it was a Buick Grand National, which is a 1980s car, Kenny. I looked it up. So they smashed the windscreen on Braun's beloved customized muscle car. Braun came out, saw the smashed windscreen. The security guard stooged them off, said, Ms. Morrison in that white van. Braun went up to the van and then tipped the van on its side. And yeah, that's your promotion for a Backlash Universal title match. I mean, I know we've got another week's SmackDown, another episode of SmackDown before the pay-per-view airs. But I mean, all this succeeded in doing was making me, and I'm sure I speak for you as well here, Kenny, all it succeeded in doing was making me less interested in this match than more interested in this match. I mean, why is it taking place? I mean, Morrison and Miz were like hiding in the van, panic-stricken, frightened to death of it reminded me of the segment from, was it 2017 when Miz was in the limousine with Bo Dallas and Curtis Axel? Was it Braun came out of the back of a rubbish bin truck? I think that was it, wasn't it?
Yeah, because had Kane not... He'd been thrown into a rubbish truck and we thought he'd been killed, and then he came out of it like a week later, unscathed.
That's it. And Miz and Bo and Curtis were like, ugh! And it was very much like that. So it's all comedy segment. And these are two guys who were supposed to believe can defeat Braun for the Universal title. I mean, how did any of these convince anyone that these two are a threat to Strowman? So, yeah, really just silly, really childish type of content, really. And it's a shame, really, because I think most of the rest of SmackDown was a good show. I enjoyed the rest of the programme.
Yeah, well, I mean, before we move on to TakeOver on Your House, obviously we're not going to talk about everything on every show, but I thought it was worth bringing up before we move on the Jeff Hardy-Sheamus stuff. We're obviously now getting that match at Backlash, and we got the kind of fallout from last week's angle. What did you think of the continuation of it this week, and are you looking forward to the match at Backlash? Have they done a good job of making you interested at seeing Sheamus and Hardy?
Well, I thought they did a good job of explaining what really happened the previous week. Jeff Hardy reckoned that he'd been KO'd from behind after he parked up his rental car. He was definitely not behind the wheel when it rammed into Elias. Went to the police station, passed all the sobriety tests. You know, the alcohol had been planted on him. He said that he definitely didn't slip. Eyewitnesses to the hit and run positively identified a man. This is a good Hardy. Positively identified a man with red hair and a red beard as the person who was behind the wheel of the car when it slammed into Elias. And he said, we all know who fits that description, right? Sheamus, you tried to take everything away from me, man, and I'll be damned if I'm going to let you get away with it. And then Sheamus came out, denied any involvement, called Hardy a failure, said all the people who gave these statements to the police, you know, were liars and enablers. And then Sheamus made a comment about Hardy's wife and kids, and Hardy left the ring, ran at Sheamus, and Sheamus pummeled him, left him laying. So at least they put this segment put Jeff Hardy in the clear. The only thing I would have liked to have seen, and I hope this does happen at Backlash, but I fear it won't, is that maybe the police should get involved here, or there should be some continuation of this storyline, and maybe Sheamus after the match should be, you know, hauled in for being behind the wheel of the car that ran into Elias. You know, there's an open end, you know, Jeff Hardy's busted. So, and then he's been released because he's not guilty. Then, you know, maybe they need to take this further, or maybe not. I don't know. So, but I thought they did a good job explaining what had happened last week. And I think we all know that Hardy is in the clear. I can't say I'm really that thrilled about the match. It feels like we've already seen it several times. And I don't know whether we have, but it just feels like we have. And you would expect Hardy to win. I mean, maybe it's going to be a two pay-per-view series and, Sheamus will score the win, and then that'll lead to a big gimmick match at Extreme Rules. Maybe that will be the direction of travel, come to think of it. And then Hardy, because it does seem like they put a lot of effort into this to just blow it off at one event. Actually, come to think of it, yeah, you would think that Sheamus is going to score a tainted victory leading to a gimmick match at the following pay-per-view. I can't imagine that after putting all this effort and, you know, all this TV time into this feud, that it's just going to end this Sunday. What do you think, Kenny?
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think it's probably a couple of match program, and it kind of makes sense for Sheamus to get the win and then Jeff to ultimately be triumphant. Well, listen, a lot of people will be curious to hear what you thought of. Now, Finn, we don't often fall out. We don't often argue, but, you know, sometimes you're wrong, and that's something you need to live with, because, you know, you don't see the joy and the glory of Todd Pettengill like the rest of us do. But he did make his triumphant return to the WWE this past weekend. He was part of the In Your House, you know, intro and all that sort of stuff. So I've got to ask, even though you were not the biggest Todd Pettengill fan, when they played the opening to In Your House with the old WWF intro, you know, instead of 50 years, for 5.5 years, the NXT, and Pettengill introduces it with the old In Your House theme, did you get that warm, fuzzy feeling? Was Todd able to just get you for that one moment or not?
Not really, no.
Oh, God. Finn! He's... Oh. Anyway, well, I mean, yeah, nothing for Todd Pettengill? No love for Todd?
Not really. I was never really a fan of his. I mean, I will say that he's still got his voice. His voice is still there. You know, that matters. You know, when you get on a bit, your voice starts going. So, I mean, I thought Todd did a good job on the segments.
He looks brilliant for 25 years later. Do you know, like, some people 25 years later look horrific. He does not look that bad.
No, absolutely not. Of course he doesn't. I mean, I thought he did a good job in the segments, but to me, he was still that same middle-of-the-road guy. I mean, I think I'd put a comment out somewhere saying that I wanted him to turn heel. I mean, that would have been tremendous.
You did. You said that would be Mark Out City. He should say, this show was the shits till I got here. Funnily enough, I mean, if you want to talk about the shits, right, so I'm not the biggest metal fan, right? I can take it or leave it. But Code Orange was one of the worst live performances I've ever seen on a wrestling show.
Oh, let me just stop you there, Kenny. Did you know, you may already know this, that they were nominated for a Grammy in 2017 for Best Metal Performance?
I just don't believe... If I had 3 months and there wasn't a lockdown and I could travel the world and listen to metal music for like a month, I'm pretty sure by day two I could find a better Grammy nominee. They were awful. They were just loud, shouty shit. It was just, you'd gone from the glory of the old school nostalgia. It's funny because I think Triple H said, you know, well, we've gone from the old school of Pettengill and all that kind of stuff to, like, you know, here's the now. And I'm like, I just don't think that people like the shouty music as much as he thinks they do.
No, I agree. I mean, Todd, to me, I mean, he was so much better than Code Orange. I mean, the only thing I liked about him was that the bass player looked a little bit like Brock Lesnar.
Did you see later on, though, when they did the bit where they cut to Code Orange and there was a close up of them all through a perspex glass and they all looked monumentally unhappy to be there?
I did see that. Yeah, it's like, this is part of the contract. You're gonna go and stand there. It's like, you know, it's pro wrestling. It's NXT. You know, it's, I mean, this has got to be pretty cool. I mean, I don't know whether it is or not. I mean, what do I know? I'm an old guy. But it's like, you know, you're there to do a job and, like, go along, show some enthusiasm. They gave you this spot at the start of the show. You did this performance. I mean, you will have sold a lot of music from this. You've been exposed to people who, surely some people do like them. It's not just me and you that, you know, we obviously didn't. But this appearance on this NXT show will have been, I think, good for their careers in some way. Lots of people who weren't aware of them now will be. And it's like, just, you know, smile a bit, show some enthusiasm and then leave.
The irony is that apparently they like drove 20 hours to do this gig.
Wow. I mean, you're in show business, for God's sake. You know, it's like...
A bit of pizzazz.
You're in show business and show that you're willing to play ball here and go along and just do what needs to be done. So you might get booked for another gig somewhere. I don't understand it. It always used to annoy me when people from outside pro wrestling, especially during the day when we had the guest Raw general manager and we had various sort of celebs coming in. It always used to annoy me when people would come in and then half-heartedly participate and, you know, seem like they were, you know, indifferent to being there or reluctant to be there. It's like, you've taken this gig, go along, you're in show business, you give it your all and you do what needs to be done. And I always remember the guy who played Wolverine in the X-Men, called Hugh Jackman. And I always thought he did a really good job. There was an angle where I think he ended up punching Dolph Ziggler on an episode of Raw.
He did, yeah. And he celebrated with Zack Ryder.
That's right. And I remember thinking, you know, good on you. You're a huge star. You could have come along here. You have set the standard. You have come along and you've shown out. You're a big star. You don't need this. You don't need to be here. You are huge anyway. You're established. If anyone could have phoned it in, it was him. And he did the and he went along and he showed enthusiasm and made it appear that he really enjoyed being there. You're an actor, for God's sake. Go along and act that you're a person who enjoys appearing on a wrestling show. That's what actors do. So, yeah, double thumbs down for Code Orange for not showing some enthusiasm for NXT. You know, I don't want to see them on a wrestling show again, Kenny.
Neither do I. Never again. Well, listen, we'll not go through everything, but let's go through all the big stuff that happened on TakeOver. We obviously had the six-woman tag match to start where Tegan Knox got a win over Dakota Kai to kind of open the show.
That was a decent opener, wasn't it? Nothing wrong with that. It warmed it. I got the show going and did everything it was supposed to do.
Yeah, exactly. It was fine. It was decent. We got Finn Balor versus Damian Priest, which I think is probably Priest's best match in WWE so far, and Balor got the win.
Yes.
But like, what is it that's not clicking about Damian Priest, do you think? Because obviously he was Punishment Martinez before. He had a big indie name, but he's kind of struggled a little bit in NXT to find an identity. And then obviously he doesn't get the win here, but does have his best performance so far. What do you think it is that's not clicking about him?
I don't know. I was thinking about that a lot as I was watching the match, and it absolutely was his best NXT match to date. Great voice, hasn't he? You know, I mean, what a voice that guy has got. And I mean, you know, if this wrestling thing doesn't work out, he could become a podcaster with a voice like that. You know, actually, in all seriousness, I think he could get voiceover work and things of that nature because he's got tremendous voice. You know, I think he's good in the ring, but it's like there's just something missing. I think he's good, but he's not great. And when you saw him in there with Finn Balor, who obviously is great, you could see there was definitely a disparity in the level of talent. And you could see that, you know, Balor did what Cena should have done with the Nexus. And Balor was a guy that really hoisted next level here and was a, you know, huge part of his best match in this company today. I don't know. I don't know whether Damian Priest can ever be anything more than a guy that puts over the bigger stars. I don't know whether he's got it. I don't know whether he's got what it takes to be that guy. Maybe he's somebody who could excel in tag teams.
Or a faction,
absolutely. I mean, I think he's got a lot of talent. And I think he's got a lot of good qualities, but I think they've just got to kind of try and work out how to maximise those. But I think he will have won more support in NXT from the people who made the decisions based on this performance here. Because he was protected on the finish as well. Balor knocked Priest off the ring apron. Priest took this hell of a bump on the ring steps. Actually, it did look quite... You could see it was very well controlled, but it was still, you know, a gutsy bump to take. So he took the bump on the ring steps, and then Balor hit him with a double foot stomp to the back of the neck and the stomach. So, you know, Balor had to really, you know, use all the big weapons in his arsenal to score the pin here. So, I mean, he looked after him on the finish, I thought.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, Triple H said in the post-takeover conference call that, you know, Priest had his best night and it's up to them and him to keep the momentum going. So we'll see if they can do that on NXT this week. We also got Keith Lee retaining the North American Championship over Johnny Gargano in a match that went 20 minutes. Keith Lee had a Black Lives Matter on the back of his jacket and on the back of his tights, which is a really great reference to have out there, especially in the current climate. How did the match work for you in terms of the dynamic of a smaller kind of chicken shit heel and a big burly baby face? Did they manage to pull it off?
I thought the match too long. I thought because of the size difference that there may be some, you know, visually it might not work, but I think it did, the last sort of few minutes. I think the spot where Johnny Gargano got the key out of his trunks and dug it in Keith Lee's eye, at that point the match kind of fell apart for me. Not in terms of, you know, went to pieces physically, but just I just couldn't take it seriously after that. And Lee did sell the eye and everything, and it enabled Gargano to take over. But it seemed unnecessary. And for someone like Gargano, who is like a real, you can see he takes his art very seriously. He's somebody that thinks everything through, and you know that the amount of effort that goes into his matches, it's almost as much effort as goes into these podcasts, Kenny.
Almost.
But to me, that was a major miscue. You know, why did you do that? You've flushed all suspension of belief as just flushed. Sorry. Lee ended up hitting the spirit bomb and the big bang catastrophe for the pin. So I think the right guy won. I don't really want to see this feud continue. I hope that's it. I'm not quite sure where Gargano goes next after this, if that is the end of the feud. I felt like the match should have been shorter and they should not have. I mean, to me, that key, using the key was just spoiled it for me, Kenny. What did you think?
I liked the match. I thought they did a good job telling the story, because I think the story they were telling is quite a hard one to tell with a smaller heel and a bigger baby face. But I do think the big question coming out of it is where does Johnny Gargano go now? Because he's, I was very critical of him not actually coming out after TakeOver Portland and telling people why he did what he did. You know, we had to wait like 2 weeks or something. I like a bit, you know, when Bret Hart, you know, turned on Everyday WrestleMania 13, he came out and cut the promo of his life the next night. That's what you got. You strike while the iron's hot. You don't wait 8 days. So I'm hoping that whatever happens with him, we get something tomorrow night as we record this to see where he's going to go. We had the backlot brawl with Velveteen Dream challenging Adam Cole for the NXT Championship. Adam Cole retained. I've got to say, I didn't seem to love this as much as everybody else did, because I felt like with the cinematic experience, my expectations were heightened and I felt it was more basic than I expected it to be. I mean, they did have Dexter Lumis and the Undisputed Era and the Uber Driver, but I don't know. I think now I'm kind of conditioned that when it's cinematic, it's going to be epic. And I just didn't feel like it quite lived up to that. What did you make of the match and the result for Adam Cole to retain?
Yeah, I agree. I didn't really like the way it was shot with it. You know, it had all the jerky camera work that was in and out of focus. And there was a lot of, you know, very harsh lighting, which I think really detracted from the match rather than enriched it. I mean, I think it was the right idea to do a different match. And I think almost every pay-per-view needs this now, where we need a match that's not in the performance center, because, you know, it's just a bit of a slog getting through matches one after the other at Performance Center. Even though I should point out that the assembled trainees and NXTers are making more noise than ever at events now. So, I mean, they really are providing, you know, not a full live event atmosphere, but certainly more of an atmosphere than they were. The ring was set up. It's surrounded by cars, and Adam Cole arrived in a monster truck, and Velveteen Dream turned up in a Lamborghini. Anything goes match, and the only rules were that it had to end in the ring. So I think they could have done a lot more. I think they should have done more close-ups and done more sort of cinematic elements, because they've kind of conditioned us to expect that now. And by not doing that, I think that's what led to disappointment in some circles, especially in Glasgow, for my co-host at the moment. I mean, I quite enjoyed it, and I think it was the right outcome. I mean, Velveteen Dream, you know, I've been a huge fan of his, but ever since he returned, he doesn't don't know, it just doesn't feel like he's got the same level of momentum as he had before the injury. I don't know whether you've noticed that or not, Kenny. Have you noticed that?
Yeah, it just doesn't seem to be firing as much as it used to. I mean, I assume that he is going to the main roster. I actually think what would be a good idea for him is to give him time off until there's fans. And in that time, let him work on whatever he needs to work on. Because Velveteen Dream, he has to vibe off the audience, for sure. You need to give him the best chance.
Definitely. I mean, it's Dexter Lumis. I'm not a fan of his at all. It's a strange partnership between those two. I think possibly Dream's hung around in NXT too long. And I would second that. You know, take him off TV, give it a couple of months, and then bring him up to Raw. Because, I mean, this was a real step down for him here. And the stipulation was that this was Dream's last match for the title for as long as Cole is NXT champion. And I can't work out who's going to defeat Adam Cole. I mean, they haven't really prepared anyone to supplant Cole at the moment. So it seems to me that Adam Cole's going to be champ for a while yet. It really wouldn't make sense to take the championship off him really within the next sort of month or two, as far as I can. I can't imagine who he's going to wrestle next. So I think, Dream, I think it should really be the end of his NXT run. Take him off TV and bring him to Raw, you know, with a massive push. I mean, you know, let's just see what this guy can do on the main roster, because we all thought this time last year and in to that, that he was going to be the next big thing. I think he still can be. And I think for every sort of week that he remains on NXT, I think, I'm not saying it makes it less likely, but it makes it less likely for me to imagine that he could be. That doesn't mean that it won't happen. So I think, he needs to have a holiday and be, you know, brought back on Raw and given that mega push. And let's just see if he can become that guy that we used to think he could be.
And then obviously we saw Karrion Kross defeat Tommaso Ciampa in fairly easy fashion, and yes. Everybody predicted that Kross would go over here, but what do you make of the way that they did it, and where does Tommaso Ciampa go from here?
Yeah, again, it's almost like him and Johnny Gargano were the, you know, the toast of NXT, the two guys who were headlining many shows, and now they're in this position where almost it's like a case of they've hung around NXT too long, so they're moving down the card now, and it's their job to put over new acts. And I think Ciampa has stated for the record that he doesn't want to go to the main roster. I'm sure he stated that.
He said that in an interview with me last week. He said that it's not that he doesn't want to go to the main roster, but he's not physically able to do that schedule. So it's easier for him in NXT because he doesn't need to work anywhere near as much.
Yes. But the thing is, what is there really left for him to do in NXT? I mean, there probably are other things that he could do, but is he going to hit the heights of, you know, previous years? And I think it's going to be very difficult for him to achieve that. And the same applies to Gargano, is that these two guys who've been the stars for so long, now they're there to put others over. And if they're content with that, then that's fine. For me, you don't really want to see guys who've been such huge stars in this role. But at the same time, you know, they are stars and they're established. And the whole point of this NXT is to create new stars. I mean, this is supposed to be the star making, you know, the star factory. You know, it's getting people ready to go to the main roster so they can be stars there, carry WWE into the future. So they are an important part of the process. And maybe it's because he lost, I think it was less than 7 minutes, the match, wasn't it? The Ciampa versus Cross match lasted a few minutes.
It was, yeah. It only lasted 6 minutes, 13 seconds.
That's right, yeah. So, I mean, Ciampa ended up losing via ref stoppage to the Cross jacket, which is a choke that Karrion Kross uses. I mean, it was the right outcome, but yeah, just surprising to see Ciampa lose in just over 6 minutes. On the other hand, you know, Kross is obviously their big project right now. He had to win. I think it would have been nice to see Ciampa have more offense before he lost. I think that's what really has been the bone of contention for most people who disapproved of this match, is that, hang on a minute, you've got a guy here who's been having matches that have been lasting over 30 minutes. He's been hit with everything, kicking out, and then loses by stoppage to this guy in just over 6 minutes. So it doesn't feel like there's sort of a consistency there, really. But yeah, great to see Cross get the win. I mean, I've been a big fan of his for a long time, and I think he really can be somebody in wrestling. I don't think he's going to hang around in NXT for that long. I would think that by the end of the year, he'll be on the main roster, and we'll see how he does. But yeah, it was strange to see Ciampa being given who he is in NXT, lose this quickly. And I think that's what most people were talking about, weren't they? Not the result, but just the way in which it played out.
And then the main event, obviously, is the big thing that people were talking about. The women main event is Charlotte Flair, Io Shirai, and Rhea Ripley. And Io Shirai was able to capture the NXT Women's Championship from Charlotte by pinning Rhea Ripley in a sort of better executed version of what they tried to do with the interim cruiserweight championship or match with Drake Maverick, Kushida, and Jake Atlas the other week. How did the match go for you? Did it live up to the expectations that you had? And was Io Shirai the right choice to walk out of TakeOver In Your House as the champ?
I think she was. I think this, had she not won the title here, it would have been very difficult to book her in a serious title program again. So I think she really needed to win here. Rhea Ripley didn't need to recapture the title. Charlotte Flair presumably now will be going full-time on Raw because she's got no reason to be on NXT again, has she really? Now she's no longer champion. So I think it was the right decision getting the title back into circulation with NXT regulars. I really enjoyed the match. I mean, the people in the crowd were making a lot of noise here, banging on the perspex, you know, and doing the chants and everything. I thought they really helped this match feel like a proper main event. I think they were consciously making more noise in this match than in previous matches. There was a really great spot where Charlotte threw Shirai through a window of the In Your House set. And then Charlotte and Rhea Ripley were battling. And then the camera went wide and we saw Shirai on the roof above the doorway of the In Your House. And she hit like a plancha on those, like a dive onto Charlotte and Rhea Ripley. So that was a huge spot there. Charlotte brought a kendo stick in. In the end, Flair held a Ripley in the figure eight. And then Shirai hit the moonsault on Ripley and pinned Ripley to become the NXT Women's Champion. Now, I watched that finish a couple of times, Kenny, and Io Shirai's knees were so close to Rhea Ripley's head on that moonsault on the landing because of the way she had to do it. I don't think she injured her, but from the camera angle that I was looking at it from, which is the same camera angle that everyone could look at it from, my God, it looked like those knees were close to her head. You know, I mean, Shirai is very precise, so I'm sure it was all right. But I watched it a couple of times. It's like, my God, those knees on that moonsault. And she comes down at a fair old rate of knots on that moonsault. And then afterwards, there was a big celebration with streamers and confetti, and she's the champ. And must have taken them a while to clear that lot up, Kenny.
You wouldn't find me doing that job. I think one of the compliments I really want to give to that finish is I thought Charlotte played it really well of how she was trying to get out of the figure eight while Rhea was getting pinned. I thought she did that really well.
Yeah. I mean, I thought it was a worthy main event. I thought all three absolutely, you know, lived up to what was expected of them for a match in this position on a major show. I thought it was the right outcome. I thought it was very well done. It was a different match. And they actually made use of the In Your House set as well, which was really good. Maybe we should have had a cameo appearance from Todd Pettingill afterwards to interview Io.
I think if we didn't have a lockdown, if we didn't have a lockdown, we probably wouldn't have an In Your House because that was where the whole idea came from. But I think if it becomes an annual thing, then they'll get Todd Pettingill. Would you like to see the TakeOver In Your House be an annual thing, or do you want it to be a one and done?
No, I'm fine with it. It was fun, and they had some, you know, silly commercials on there. They had Adam Cole in an Ico Pro advert, and there were some nods to the past when Johnny Gargano was making his entrance through the In Your House set. There was a picture of Doc Hendricks on the wall, and there was the superstars, cookie sandwiches, with performers advertising them. There was a bit of a comedy segment with Shawn Michaels and Triple H and Road Dogg. They were trying to work out how to turn a 1990s computer on, so that was quite funny with them sending themselves up. So, I mean, but none of that, you know, the silly sort of 90s references didn't overshadow the action. It was just, you know, that was a very small part of it. And it was just, you know, it was fun stuff. But yeah, I'd like to see it becoming an annual thing. Absolutely. I think, you know, they've got the set now. I thought the graphics looked tremendous. I thought they did a really good job on them, really bold and striking. And yeah, I think they should bring it out each year. What do you think, Kenny?
Oh, 100%. I loved it. I thought it was great. And it also, it's a way to kind of promote your archives as well. You know, you've got like, you know, 20, however many in your house events, like you can go back and watch in the network. So I think I think sometimes like once a year in that way, it's a fun nostalgia thing to have. Let's move on to Raw. So we've got Raw. I thought Raw was a pretty eventful show. We opened up with Asuka coming out, and then Bayley and Sasha came out to obviously, you know, gloat about their victory with the women's tag titles. And then Charlotte came out to basically say, you know, get out of the way. This is about me and Asuka. And then the Iconics came out to remind everybody that this Sunday at Backlash is going to be a women's tag title triple threat with the Iconics, the champs, and Nikki Cross and Alexa Bliss. But it ended up kind of parlaying into a triple threat non-title tag match with Bayley and Sasha, the Iconics, and Asuka and Charlotte. Where Asuka and Charlotte got the win, and I thought the finish was pretty inventive, actually, where Charlotte Flair kind of had Billie Kay taken care of, and then Charlotte goes up top for a moonsault, but Asuka just tags herself in while Charlotte is in position to do the moonsault, enters the ring, puts Billie Kay in the Asuka lock, and gets the win. And Charlotte and Asuka are not friends. And I thought it really kind of hyped the main event really well. What did you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's the old reluctant partners gimmick. I mean, this is, you know, this has been used before, and it usually works, actually, if you've got people with talent. And I thought they did a really good job there with Asuka and Charlotte tagging, you know, they would tag each other. They would tag themselves into the match. It wasn't like Charlotte was tagging Asuka into the match or vice versa. So, I mean, that was definitely the story of the match. Bayley and Banks disappeared by the end. Just weren't really a factor, were they?
Yeah, I mean, luckily, I'm glad they weren't the ones taking pinfalls here. They needed to be out of town.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I'm sorry, but Billie Kay looked crummy again. I mean, she looked lousy against Bayley, and Bayley was doing, like, all the work or most of the work. It was a decent match. I mean, it was a story match. It was all about promoting the main event. It was really, as I was watching it, I was thinking, who's Asuka wrestling at Backlash? Oh yeah, it's Nia Jax. Like, Nia Jax was just not mentioned and not a factor in this. I mean, I know you wouldn't have wanted to add a seventh person to this match, but it was just strange that this was all about promoting a match between Asuka and Charlotte Flair rather than the match between Asuka and Nia Jax, which is at the pay-per-view, as we'll, you know, we'll get to the main event, and obviously Nia Jax did make an appearance.
Well, let's go straight into it where we're talking about Asuka and Charlotte. I mean, we have the main event where it's a sort of 27-minute match, I think it was, with Asuka and Charlotte.
Long, isn't it? Long.
And the whole idea here is that, obviously, Asuka has never been able to beat Charlotte. She's beat everybody else, but she's never been able to beat Charlotte. And in the two big matches at WrestleMania 34 and SmackDown in the spring of 2019 before WrestleMania, Charlotte got the two big wins. So here they had this big, long, epic match where Asuka was going toe-to-toe with her, and then Nia Jax came out and kind of delivered a distraction, allowing Charlotte to beat Asuka. I guess my question I was going to ask you was, do you think this is a good thing that they're kind of using that Asuka-Charlotte thing and not quite giving you it yet to build, maybe to build to it? Did it work? And how did the match live up to their other two big ones that they've had in the past?
I thought the match did drag a little. I thought it lasted too long. I mean, it was well done. I mean, these two, I mean, on the main roster, I would say these two are the best two in-ring performers in WWE. Female performers. I mean, Asuka, in many ways, one of the best all-round performers. And Charlotte's really good as well. I think Asuka is a better wrestler than Charlotte Flair. Yeah, I enjoyed the match, but really, towards the end, I just thought, yeah, you've been out there too long now. And it was seemed pretty obvious that Naya was going to make an appearance at the end as well. So that, and she needed to, of course, because they've got a match at Backlash on Sunday. So of course she had to make an appearance. It was a bit of a cliched ending with Naya coming out and then Asuka taking her eye off the ball and running over and nailing Naya, and then Charlotte scored the pin after that. Kind of finished, the pin kind of looked a bit naff, I felt. And then afterwards, Naya came into the ring and smashed Asuka with a Samoan drop. So it was, yeah, it was good, but just kind of a bit predictable, really, the ending. I imagine it's hard for me to believe that Naya's going to defeat Asuka at Backlash. So it seems to me that maybe we're going to go back to Asuka and Charlotte Flair next week, do you think?
I mean, it feels to me like maybe what we're building to, and I am totally okay with this if this is where it's going, that when we get to SummerSlam, the big two title matches for the women's titles are going to be Charlotte and Asuka and Bayley and Sasha, which is not a bad place to be. And it feels like they are telling the story of building to Asuka finally getting the big win over Charlotte. It feels like that's where it's going. So I'm kind of here for the ride. I thought the match was a little bit too long as well, but I think the environment kind of was part of the reason for that, is because I think for a match that long, you really need a crowd who are, you know, not being basically, you know, chimed in to be there. Even though I think those people were doing a really good job actually in that role. But I enjoyed the main event. I enjoyed the story of it, and you know, let's just pray to God that Asuka defeats Nia Jax and we can move on.
I mean, it did sort of feel like this was a punishment to Nia, really, for what happened on Raw the previous week.
Yeah.
She only had a very limited involvement in this program, and just had this one thing to do, which she was able to do without injuring anyone, thankfully. It'd be interesting to see how the match plays out at Backlash. I mean, I have to believe that Asuka's going to win, but it will be, I'm curious to see how many minutes it takes her to score that victory. So I'll be monitoring that very closely.
I do want to very quickly mention the Viking Raiders and the Street Profits did a decathlon, and there was a moment when they were doing hurdles where, I think it was Ivar, just ran through the hurdles, and I don't know why it made me laugh so much, but I spent a good 5 minutes laughing at that. I thought their skits were really fun. They were naff. I mean, they were really naff, but like, I don't know. I like those offshoot location things, and it's weirdly made me more into both teams. So yeah, maybe some people don't like them, but I kind of dug them.
Yeah, there's something for everyone here, wasn't there, with that in their decathlon challenge. You know, first challenge was a 1600 meter dash. Montez Ford won that, of course, against, I'm sure it was Ivor. There was archery, Raiders won that. There was flip cup, Profits won that. Sword fighting, Profits forfeited. Stick fighting, I think it was called, Raiders won that. There was a dance-off. The Profits used Shawn Michaels' music, and the Raiders used Fandango's music. And we had the ongoing, the running gag, Kenny, of the woman, female judge, or the female passerby, finding Ivar really attractive, but not Eric, not so much.
It's a really good through line.
So we had turkey leg eating pole vault, and it ended 5-5 in a dead heat.
So, I mean, they may have to go to Backlash to settle this. I've got to say, usually I have been really into other weeks. I thought that the Lashley MVP Drew stuff, I didn't think it was as good as last week. But I think the match could be really good, but I feel like it didn't quite have that kind of oomph of go home, you know, pizzazz, as you would say, that I wanted it to have.
That's right. Yeah, it was Lashley and MVP versus the Viking Raiders, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Drew McIntyre was at ringside. Lashley forced Eric to tap out to the full Nelson. Then afterwards, Lashley applied full Nelson on Ivar. Street Profits, who were at ringside, they tried to drag Lashley off Ivar, and it took Drew McIntyre, who was at ringside, to nail Lashley with the claymore to, you know, see him off, to send him fleeing from the ring. So yeah, it kind of felt like it peaked a week too early, hype for this match, but I still think it can really sizzle. it's hard for me to believe that Lashley's going to win, though. it's hard for me to picture that. But I think they can still have a hell of a match.
And then elsewhere on the show, we also...
Sorry, Kenny, can I just mention, I wrote this down for the express purpose of bringing it up during this podcast. During the Lashley and MVP versus Viking Raiders match, we went backstage for a word from Lana, who was watching backstage. Mm-hmm. And she stated that she realised that she'd been concentrating too much on Lashley. Recognising the error of her ways, Lana has decided that she needs to concentrate on her own career. So there we were, wondering who Asuka's going to wrestle after Backlash. Probably Lana.
Can you imagine?
Big push again.
Oh, not again. I can't handle it. I can't. Oh, so bad. Thank you for bringing up that misery to me.
Oh, that's an image to leave with today, Kenny. An image for all of you to leave with. Lana receiving a title match.
We also had the Peep Show with Christian and Edge and Randy Orton. I do have to, though, give, before we talk about the Peep Show, I have to give props to Charlie Caruso, because Randy Orton was like, how many guests are there on the Peep Show? And she was like, one. And he was like, I think there might be two, Charlie, and walked away. And she then, like, where the camera was focused on her, was like internally in her head and with her fingers counting out the number of people. This woman can sell shit like nobody else. Did you spot this?
Yeah, I did. And I mean, I'm sort of, because Charlie's never really presented as a fool. I mean, she could have come back and said, well, so you're going to get crash the segment then, Randy? Is that what you're saying? She maybe should have said something like that. I felt like Charlie should have had a little moment there where she just understood what Randy Orton was saying and said it out loud rather than doing that. But I mean, it's, you know.
She was great. Like,
you know, she's a real talent, you know.
Yeah, like the whole, it's so simple, right? It's like, Randy Orton's the guy that's going to come out, but she just sells it as if it's this like big Romeo Shakespeare moment in her life. It's great. What did you make of the Peep Show, though, with Christian kind of giving Edge the tough love to try and build up this match? I mean, you can see Edge did an interview with ESPN, Orton's done one. They basically do not want to be calling this the greatest match ever. They are fairly annoyed that that's what it's being branded as. And they're kind of having to run with it. How did Edge and Christian do? Did they hype it well? Did they do a good job of kind of trying to make Edge have some layers to him? Talk me through your thoughts on the segment.
It was just like Christian turned heel on Edge, wasn't it? You're thinking, oh, it's Randy Orton. Randy Orton's going to make an appearance. Is he going to do a run-in? And it's just, oh, it's Christian that's doing the heel turn. It's Christian who's attacking Edge verbally. To Edge, you're running. I think you're running on fumes. You know, you couldn't have. What was the line he used? What was it? I've got to be honest with you. Wrestling match ever. I don't even think you could pull that off in your prime. Christian to Edge. And Edge is there like, what's going on? My longtime best pal. You know, what's he doing to me here? He's running me down.
Kick a dog while he's down, why don't you?
He's knocking me down. But he had a master plan, Kenny. He was knocking him down so he could build him back up. So in the
There's
end...
There's methods in the madness.
That's it. It was the reverse psychology or something like that. So it was just... In the end, Christian said to Edge, we have confidence in you. We think you can do this. We think you're as good now as you've ever been. We think you can win. We think you can have the greatest wrestling match ever. I think his voice might have trailed off a little bit when he said those few words. Actually, I don't think he did, dude, because Christian's a real pro. And yet they're there to sell this crap, whether they believe in it or not. You know, you work for a wrestling company. You know, you're a paid shill. Start shilling. You know, that's what you're there to do. So, but that's it. You know, this is what the company is... is the slogan or the marketing concept for this match and for this pay-per-view. And the bottom line is, if you haven't been able to get that changed, you need to get on board with it and sell it the best you can. That's what you do as a pro wrestler. You're in show business, you know, just like Code Red. They're supposed to be in show business as well.
Their name's Code Orange, but yeah. You're right. You've forgotten their name already. Code Blue, whatever the fuck they're called.
Fantastic, I got the name wrong. Brilliant.
Anyway, so... I mean, that's just Code Orange all over for you, isn't it?
Christian, so I think in the end, you know, Christian really built Edge up, and Edge is there and he's feeling, you know, motivated, you know, he's fired up. And then Randy Orton appears on the big screen and said the expectations for the match at Backlash were astronomical. He's going to embarrass Edge and send him home where he belonged. You know, and I think the line he used was, your redemption ends at Backlash. Edge said defiantly, you know, no, it doesn't end there. And that was it. So I don't know, Kenny. I mean, it's a strange one, match. The whole way it's been promoted is almost comical. It almost seems like a rib on Edge and Orton and us, the viewers, us, the fans. I'm just mystified by the whole thing. I mean, even if they have like a tremendous match, it's not going to be the greatest wrestling match ever. It isn't. It's just not possible that these two will have the greatest wrestling match ever. So I'm just sort of a bit perplexed by the whole thing. And I find Edge as a babyface totally unlikable. I think the roles... I mean, Edge just needs to turn heel. To me, he's just a natural heel. It's hard for me to really root for him as a babyface. And also, I haven't really recovered from the WrestleMania match yet. I feel like I saw like enough of Edge and Randy Orton for the rest of the year at WrestleMania. So I'm not really looking forward to the match, if I'm honest. I'm sure you are, Kenny.
I am actually. I've heard that it's taped and it's supposed to be really good. So that gives me a little bit of positivity about it. I don't really understand why they've paid all this money to bring Edge back. And you can tell he's really trying, right? He really wants to do good story work. That's what he's really trying to do. And it feels like kind of, you know, he's done one match and they're kind of already taking the piss out of him on like match two. And I just don't understand it, because you're paying this guy so much money to come back. I don't get it. I don't get why this would... You know, I saw someone was, I think it was Sean Ross Sapp, had put a tweet out, and like Matt Hardy had liked it, because, and it was something like, you know, how am I supposed to buy the Edge? Well, let me get the tweet here, let me read it. Where is it? It's hard for me to get behind a promo about Edge self-doubting that he can live up to the greatest wrestling match of all time, Monica, that we all know should have never been imposed to begin with.
Mm.
And that's kind of where it is. It's like, why would you do it? So... And if it's a rib, like, why? Who's the rib to? Like, what's the point in it? I don't get the idea. Like, surely you would want to, if you know, Edge has got 2-3 years in him or something, you want to build it up and make the most out of it that you can, not just be like, let's just throw a greatest match thing out there and make fun of it. Just, I don't get it.
No, not either. It's like some... I mean, obviously, you would think that Edge and Orton will have expressed concerns about this tagline for the show and for the match, and they've been overruled, or maybe they haven't. Maybe they just know that it would be pointless to even express reservations about it or offer an alternative marketing campaign, and that once Vince is hell-bent on something, it's just going to happen. But it just seems like handicapping them before they've even sent them out there. It's just made things so difficult for them, and to hinder them in this fashion. I just don't get it at all, but I guess that's pro wrestling. At times, it doesn't make any sense.
Any last things you want to cover from Raw before we finish off this week? Anything else that caught your fancy? Or caught your eye? Apart from the great moment where Aleister Black came into the shot and dived Seth Rollins.
Well, that was pretty good, yeah. We had Rey Mysterio. He said that prognosis was... he was there via Skype. He said the prognosis on his eye was promising, and that he was going to kick Seth Rollins' head when he returned. And then Rollins invited Mysterio and Dominic to Raw next week. And then right after that, Aleister Black dived on Rollins, who was behind the announce desk, and that led to Aleister Black and Humberto Carrillo versus Murphy and Austin Theory. So maybe, you know, I imagine that Ray and Dominic will be on Raw next week. So that will be quite interesting to see. Don't think there was really much else on the show. Andrade ended up winning a triple threat match, so he'll face Apollo Crews for the US title of Backlash. Really wasn't a whole lot of interest in that, apart from at ringside, Andrade, it was Kevin Owens versus Andrade versus Angel Garza, and Andrade and Angel were at ringside battling, and then Zelina was accidentally knocked down, so presumably that will go somewhere. Andrade pinned Garza after Owens had nailed Garza with the stunner, so Owens was obviously miffed by the outcome that he'd set up the pin for another guy. So it feels to me, Kenny, like Owens at the moment is treading water as a babyface, very much like Alexa Bliss on the other chat on SmackDown. Definitely feel like Owens needs, you know, it's almost a cliche. Oh, well, turn him heel. That's going to be the antidote to this. But it just feels to me like Owens is kind of floundering at the moment. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, him being a kind of background player to the US. I mean, it really feels like Owens should be the US champion going up against Andrade. It doesn't feel like he should be the person in the background. And Apollo Crews, I mean, already forgetful.
Yeah.
Like, you're forgettable as a champion. It's just nice guy, like, and a great wrestler, but just Steve Blackman levels of charisma.
Yeah.
It's just,
I just hope they don't end up getting relegated to the kickoff show this weekend. I fear they might. So I hope, you know, just to give the US title, you know, some credibility and some dignity, that this match should be on the main show and that they should get some time for it as well. I hope Crews, even though I don't really think a whole lot of Crews, I really would like to see him succeed in this company. And I'm just hoping that the title reign doesn't end at Backlash.
It's like a Bayley thing, though. You know, even though we've not really enjoyed Bayley's run the last couple of years, like, we're more than happy that she's killing it now. That's great. Yeah. And I'd love to see Apollo Crews do the same thing. I just don't know what the best environment he's ever been in for getting over was when he was in Titus Worldwide with Titus O'Neil and Dana Brooke. That was the best that he's ever kind of, that was the best thing he was ever involved in, because at least it was fun and it was, people dug the act. But ever since, it's just never gone anywhere. Anyway.
It looks like Apollo Crews needs to do what Bayley did and just find this character that works for him and be allowed to implement it and really develop it. And, you know, that to me is his way forward from here. Even though he's champion right now, it doesn't feel to me like this is for keeps, like this is going to be a long-term thing. And, you know, I hope it can be. I hope he can do something to make us believe that he's a guy that can be a long-term champ. He needs to do the character, obviously needs a lot of work. He could do with a character. That's what he could do with. You know, not the character needs a lot of work. He needs a character.
Yeah, he needs one. Well, listen, that's it for us this week. Lot of stuff to cover. We will be on the Overrun talking about issue 135, I think it is.
135, which came with an A5 supplement entitled The 20 Matches You Must See.
We will talk about that, and we'll talk about Shawn Michaels coming out in Montreal and teasing fans with Bret Hart.
Watched that before, Kenny. It was fantastic.
Brilliant segment, well worth watching from the August 10th Raw 2005. I can't remember the exact date.
I think it was August 15th. Okay. I think it was August 2005 anyway. But yeah, we'll be talking about that on the Overrun.
Any plugs for us, Finn?
No plugs, Kenny. Apart from the next what's and we'll be going up this week. Hopefully we'll be going up before this, hopefully we'll be going up sometime tomorrow.
Great, perfect. Well, listen, thank you everybody for listening. You can check out more of our stuff, as Finn said, on Patreon at patreon.com/insidetheropes. We've got no live events, so this is really the kind of what keeps us going. So we appreciate all of you who have kind of stepped up and pledged for us while you can here in these tough times. So we will keep doing more to earn your lovely pledge money that you send us. Also, youtube.com /InsideTheRopes. You can get interview content over there that I've been doing, conference call with Triple H, one-on-one interview with Tommaso Ciampa. I'm on some more conference calls this week with some of the big players from Backlash, so look out on our YouTube channel for that. And that's it, Finn. I hope you have a good week.
And you as well, Kay. And look forward to our communication next Tuesday on the podcast.
We'll be talking about Backlash next week, all the fallout and more. Take care, everybody. If I be tonight, if I'm sad tonight.